The pine and sandalwood-scented changing room shifted Hobart's mood, as it was meant to, and centered his attention on his body. Hobart stripped off his business clothes and dropped them into the hamper. His exercise clothes hung on racks. Today, for his fencing lesson, he chose a skin suit and the leather armor. His coach didn't approve of leather, but he was in no mood to pamper his coach. He glanced at himself in the mirror with satisfaction. Barrel chest, flat belly, well-muscled legs, erect posture, firm mouth. Not a slack, flabby fiber in him, mind or body. A man fit to lead. In the exercise room itself, he warmed up with the standard sets, then stretched. As he was twisting himself into a pretzel, trying not to look at himself, he hated these stretches, which were at best undignified, the door opened and the Swordmaster came in. His own coach would not have dared. Hobart had made it clear that he needed no supervision in warm-up. But the Swordmasters were an old, proud breed, and he put up with their arrogance for the sake of their skill. Bunny had never taken up fencing, and had resolutely refused to have a Swordmaster at his estate, even when most families did.
Lord Consuline, your form needs improvement.
Hobart was proud that he was able to conquer a flash of anger.
Instruct me.
The Swordmaster bent and twisted his own body into the stretch and held it, looking at Hobart from under his arm.
You are not keeping the knee straight, and you are bending the spine too much in the thoracic span, and not enough in the lumbar.
He unwound, not red in the face or breathless.
Try again.
Hobart twisted and tangled himself into the required knot. He knew what it was for, but he disliked it, and knew he had been skimping on it for months. The Swordmaster's hands steadied him, and then pushed and pulled. Hobart felt a pop in his spine, and the sudden ease of a cramp he had not realized he had.
Like that. You really should let Oris spot you in this for several months.
Hobart untwisted carefully.
I'll consider it.
Good. If you are ready.
The Swordmaster nodded toward the hall. Hobart turned to the Swordmaster as they passed through the archway.
Is it true that all Swordmasters must have killed with the blade?
It is a tradition.
Hobart wanted to know what it felt like, but could think of no polite way to ask. And he wondered which blade. The Swordmasters taught the use of all blades, had mastered all styles. Oris held out practice masks, transparent reinforced ceram with touch signaling circuitry embedded, and the warm-up blades. Hobart glanced at Oris, wondering what he'd told Master Yagen. He suspected Oris of reporting on more than his fencing skill. He did, after all, have to take the occasional call during a lesson, and Oris might have overheard scraps of conversation. But nothing important, he thought. Nothing that would interest a Swordmaster, anyway. Masked and gloved, with blade in hand, he faced Master Yagen on the strip. The salute, old-fashioned, formal, an utter waste of time, and yet it set the emotional tone for what followed. The initial touches, boring, when all Hobart wanted was to get this session out of the way so he could return to his plotting. Master Yagen's tip smacked into his face shield, which flared red. For an instant, Hobart could not speak for anger.
Touch!
Your mind wandered, Lord Consuline.
Behind the arc of gleaming protection, Master Iagan's expression was unreadable. Quiet, a little stern, but neither anger nor apprehension.
My apologies.
This was, after all, one of the reasons he had stayed with fencing. The need to concentrate utterly on what he was doing. But Oris never struck him so early in a session. Still, the Swordmaster was who he was, and probably thought fencing was the most important thing in the universe. Hobart collected these scattered thoughts, locked them away, and concentrated on Master Iagen's blade. Master Iagen's last riposte was so powerful it blew through Hobart's parry and punched him lightly in the chest.
Touch.
He was not expected to defeat a Swordmaster, only to show that he had been working. He had indeed, and his next attack actually achieved a touch. His spirits soared. He had never made a touch on the Swordmaster from Seven before. All that work with weights must have done it. 20 touches, 16 to the swordmaster and 4 to him, then a break to stretch out again before taking up the heavier blades.
Your right forearm is definitely stronger, Lord Consuline.
Loris has me doing weight work.
Good, but I noticed that your left arm is still substantially weaker. There should be no more than 5% difference in strength, unless someone has suffered an injury. Have you?
It's stronger than last year.
Indeed it is. But the imbalance affects more than your offhand fencing, my lord. It also affects the set of your spine and your gait. You need to balance them, just as you balance work and play.
I have no time for play, Swordmaster. Surely you have heard of the terrible crisis that faces us? Lord Thornbuckle was killed by terrorists.
Yes, of course. But that makes my point. You must be balanced to withstand such blows. It is the failure of balance in your society which makes it vulnerable. The undisciplined stagger when the blow falls.
I do not intend to stagger and fall.
Hobart caught a glimpse of himself in the mirrors that lined the hall, flushed and truculent. Dangerous.
Nor will you, my lord, I'm sure. Your work here, the discipline needed to achieve the level you've achieved, sustains you, along with your native talents. But as each movement balances contraction of one muscle group with extension of another, so the steadfast must balance strain and relaxation.
I find relaxation in this.
With a wave, Hobart included the entire exercise suite.
That is good. You have a warrior's heart, which finds ease in growing stronger.
Praise of a sort. He would take it. A warrior's heart he knew he had, and he could feel himself growing stronger. When the lesson ended, Hobart invited Master Eoghan to dinner at the family table, but the swordmaster declined.
With your permission, my lord, I will walk in your gardens. I must take ship tomorrow, and I am not often able to stretch my legs in such beauty.
Hobart anticipated that request, although he still did not understand Master Eoghan's fascination with the garden. Discreet surveillance had revealed that the man did not tumble a maid behind the hedges or use any sort of communications device to contact a confederate. He always did what he asked permission to do, strolled along the pebbled garden paths, stopping now and then to sniff a flower. He pretended to fence with the topiary knight, and if one of the gardener's cats appeared, he would pick it up and stroke it. At the far end of the garden, he always paused to watch the black-finned fish in the lily pond. Not what Hobart had expected of a swordmaster, but they were known to have strange habits.
Is the swordmaster still here?
Hobart gave Delphine a look that shut her up instantly.
He's here, but he's leaving tomorrow. Why?
I just wanted to meet him.
You have no reason to meet him. You do not take fencing seriously.
Delphine could strike a pretty pose with foil in hand, and in fencing whites, and in the garden in front of the rose hedge, looked quite exciting that way. But her footwork was execrable, and she had never shown any determination in learning better. He would not have been too pleased if she had, but her failure to oppose him, even on this, was another proof of her weakness. Luckily, he had been able to choose other gene lines for his sons. Delphine picked at her shellfish.
I called Miranda today, but her private secretary wouldn't put me through. I was able to make an appointment for tomorrow when she's taking condolence calls.
A quick flash of anger that a secretary prevented his wife, Lady Consuline, from contacting Miranda Thornbuckle, flared and died.
That's good.
It wasn't important, after all. Miranda would find out soon enough that what power she had had through Bunny was gone, water into sand.
Hobart, are you in danger?
Hobart smiled at her, surprised and pleased by her solicitude.
Me? No, my dear. Bunny made enemies I have not made.
He had others, but none that would dare have him killed.
And besides, I am more careful. We have excellent security. Do not worry about me or about yourself and the children.
It's all so terrible. Pirates capturing Bronn and then the terrorists.
It won't happen again. I'll see to that.
But Hobart, how? You aren't...
If she says I'm not important, I'll kill her right here.
He felt himself stiffening and saw in her face the reaction to his expression. Her mouth snapped shut, tears filled her eyes, and she looked down at her plate.
I know it's hard for you to believe, but I am not a non-entity.
Oh, Hobart, I didn't say that. I didn't mean...
And I can and will keep you safe, and others. It's my duty, and I have never shirked my duty.
Of course not.
Up came her napkin to dab at the tears.
We have had laxity in high places. With all due respect for Lord Thornbuckle, and I have known Bunny all my life, he simply did not have the moral fiber to do what was necessary. I will not make that mistake. When I am first speaker, and I shall be Delphine in a matter of days, things will be handled very differently. None of his weak deference to the entrenched bureaucracy, which is always afraid to make changes, lest it mean the loss of influence. I will make the decisions, and I will save the realm.
He looked up to find her staring at him, eyes still wide. He pointed his knife at her.
And you, my dear, will say nothing of this to anyone. I have no doubt that the Grand Council will be glad to elect someone who has a clear vision of what should be done, but I don't want them confused by your version of events first. Is that clear?
Yes, Hobart.
You will say nothing to Miranda tomorrow.
No, Hobart.
And you will quit messing about with that crab and eat properly.
Yes, Hobart.
That's better.
If she would just confine herself to doing what he told her and not argue, she would be an exemplary wife. Hobart could imagine her in the palace, greeting those he invited to the necessary social events. Delphine was good at social events. Decorative, tactful, soft-voiced. Like Miranda, Bunny's widow in that respect. But his wife. His tool. Baron Serrano checked his appearance in the mirror yet again. Like all his class who had not actually disgraced themselves, he had his promotion to jig, and in an hour the ensigns were to appear for the promotion ceremony in the captain's office. His parents, in accordance with tradition, had sent him their old insignia, a pair from each, and a credit chip for his contribution to the celebration in the junior officer's mess. That was handy, given that his pay was now zeroed out. They'd said nothing about that in their accompanying note. He wondered if it had been written before they found out. He wondered if they simply couldn't think of anything to say. Luckily, these lower-level promotions didn't require dress uniforms, and he had a natural knack for looking trim. His mind strayed, as it often did, to Esme Sweeza, whose fluffy brown hair sometimes appalled her as much as it delighted him. She would never understand, he was sure, how those stray wisps made him feel. He hadn't heard from Esme in weeks, but they'd both been shipbound. He hadn't expected to be quite so susceptible to everything that reminded him of her, but he assumed that would pass.
Come on, Baron!
With a last glance, no, hairs had not suddenly sprouted from his ears, he turned and followed the rest to the ceremony. The ceremony itself was brief, but the aftermath wasn't. Each newly promoted jig had, by tradition, donated a dozen drink chits into the pool, and the first 12 enlisted personnel who recognized the new rank each got one. Baron, one of the last in alphabetical order on this ship, found that he was being ambushed at every crossing until his last chit was gone. 4 hours later, the first of the new ensign assignees came aboard, a ship-to-ship transfer from the Cape Hay, which had ferried them from Sector HQ. They looked incredibly young. He couldn't believe he had ever been that green. He kept almost looking behind himself when one of them called him Sir. The Jurfalcon was on what would have been a routine patrol if it weren't for the persistent fear that the new Texas colonies were up to something. Normally, Sector 7 was quiet. The transit points into it from Benignity space made invasion from their main enemy unlikely. Now, however, they were expecting trouble. Within the ship itself, all routines were performed under the restrictions of Level 2 alert. A few days of this, Baron thought, and people would start slacking off, not quite dogging down the blast barriers, not remembering to close off the shower room drains after use, forgetting one or more of the niggling little details that might, if they came under surprise attack, save lives or waste them. Junior officers and senior NCOs were the only defense against this natural relaxation of precautions, and they had lost 8 senior NCOs to the medical restrictions on rejuve recipients. Baron took his turn at inspection with a keen understanding of its importance. He had, after all, lost an uncle to someone's failure to dog a blast barrier, and had grown up with the story. But Cape Hay had brought new orders, and Captain Escobar called Baron in to discuss them.
You remember that professor who's been staying with your wives, dependents?
Yes, sir.
Well, we're going to stop by to pick her up, and take her with us to Sector 1 HQ, where we're to meet a diplomat of some sort from the Lone Star Confederation, and transport her back to Castle Rock. And it might be a good idea for you to try to convince those women to do something other than sit there eating up fleet resources. They may not listen, but they've been telling Professor Meyerson they can't do anything without your permission. Oh, and you have mail.
Baron read the message cube as soon as he had a free moment, which was hours later. His parents had recorded it, but the full weight of the Serrano dynasty lay behind it. He was young to marry anyway, and with Fleet having already assigned him responsibility for the maximum number of dependents, how could he even think of marrying? Of course, they were sure that Lieutenant Sweeza would understand, and if she truly cared for him, she would see to it that she made things easier, not harder, for him. There need be no unseemly haste.
How can I think of marrying? How can I not? Unseemly haste. We've known each other for years now. We've been through a blood horde attack, the machinations of envious troublemakers, a very tricky hostage extrication, and I'm not going to be told I'm too young, too inexperienced, too anything else to get married. I am a jig, not some wet ears ensign fresh out of the academy.
He loved her. She loved him. It was so simple, if only other people would leave them alone. Perhaps she could get leave and they could meet somewhere, privately. He toyed briefly with the idea of running away and getting married secretly in spite of his family. That wouldn't be fair to Esme, though. The land bride Sweeza would expect would require more than a hasty ceremony before some local magistrate. Still, with the ship detached for diplomatic duty, maybe, just maybe, they could manage to meet.
Mail drop, Lieutenant.
Chief Conway handed Esme the hard copy list. Esme managed not to sigh. All these new security procedures ate time, since every piece of incoming mail at every mail drop required her to check and initial it. Luckily, they could pick up mail only when reasonably near fleet relays. Still, she could not believe that all these security measures were necessary on a small ship like this. She ran her eye down the list, noting that the chief had flagged 3 names, a pivot major and 2 sergeants minor. They had received more than a sig beyond the mean number of contacts and from multiple sources.
No packages.
No, sir. Not for them. There's one for you, though. And Pivot Major Gunderson is getting married at the end of this tour. The return addresses match his next of kin address, his future in-laws address, and the medical center on Rockhouse Major.
Medical center? Oh, of course, Gunderson's neuro-enhanced. Is his betrothed, too?
No, civilian softsider. Gunderson's trying to get a control implant approved.
That made sense. He wouldn't want to tear his spouse apart by accident.
Still, a civilian marriage?
Security's been all over it. The family's not fleet, but they've been subcontractors for 2 generations.
Esme let her gaze drift to the next name.
Farley's parents have sicked the whole family on her to get her to leave fleet and work for their shipping consortium. She says she's been hassled for years and just trashes the notes.
A message cube from Baron. Esme put it aside for later viewing. It bore the sticker that meant it had passed sensors at Sector HQ. He must have told his family by now. His grandmother already knew. This was probably about their response to his telling them about Esme. She still hadn't heard back from her own family, though with the long transit times the new security regs imposed, that wasn't too surprising. She hoped they'd reply promptly. She and Baron would have only a short window of opportunity for their wedding, and while they wanted it to be small and informal, she still wanted it to feel like a wedding, which meant family present. Her other mail was all official business addressed to her position on Shrike. All but the package, much battered after its passage through one checkpoint after another, with Brunn Meager's name in the sender ID square.
Package from Brunn?
Esme hadn't heard from her since she left for Castle Rock with her babies. She noticed the rumpled seal tape, where security had tried to open it, as required by the new rules. She laid her hand on the ID plate, wondering momentarily how Brunn had acquired her handprint, and the seal tape flicked free. Esme unfolded the wrapping, aware of security watching her. The last of the paper folded back to reveal a strip of exquisite embroidery.
Oh!
As wide as her hand, a long strip, she unfolded it carefully, that was nearly as tall as she was, and every centimeter covered with white-on-white embroidery and lace. She hardly dared touch it with bare hands. She felt she should be wearing white gloves to protect it. She laid it gently across her lap and went back to the box. Under the folded strip was a square of some sheer white fabric, more like a net, encrusted with tiny seed pearls. And under that, several pages of drawings, sketches of a gown. A wedding gown, Esme realized, with long sleeves and a high collar. It was more severe than she would have expected Brunn to choose. It had almost the suggestion of a uniform about the shoulders. The data cube in the same package explained.
Baron's acquisitions need a way to support themselves, Hazel told me. And you need a wedding gown. Handwork of this quality is rare. If they're working for a good designer, they'll be well paid for it. So, I took the liberty of talking to some designers. I assume you don't want to pay a year's salary on it. For the fleet hero who rescued me, and an introduction to the craftswomen doing work of this quality, Gorin Heil is willing to design your gown. He's not considered as good as Maurice Limited. Oh, but I did like the slight military flair.
It was not the first time Brunn had tried to plan their life for them. This was the fourth, Esme thought, trying not to resent it. Brunn had grown up expecting things to go her way. Money and beauty and luck had failed her only once. No wonder she wanted to go back to running the world, or at least her friends' lives. She was only reverting to normal. She didn't mean to flaunt her power. Probably. Esme looked at the drawings and embroidery again. For a moment, Esme imagined herself in that gown, made of such gorgeous stuff. She would look... No, she must not think about that, not now. It was far too grand a gown for her, for a plain lieutenant in fleet who wanted a quiet family wedding.
But for the land bride Sweeza?
It was not too grand for the land bride Sweeza, but she was not marrying Baron as land bride. She paused in folding the strip of embroidery to replace it in the box.
Am I?
A cascade of difficulties unfolded in her mind, beginning with her position as land bride Sweeza. What if someone thought her marrying Baron had anything to do with that? With the historical position of Sweeza of Altiplano and the regular space service, or Altiplano's ambiguous position within the Familius Regnant? What if her family thought that? What if... She did not like even thinking about this, about the land link that was supposed to have been formed with the land bride ceremony. What if the land itself, land Sweeza, thought her marriage to Baron Serrano meant something beyond love, and she hadn't yet made formal application for a status change? Quickly, without stopping to think about any of it, she called up the appropriate forms.
Officer application for life partner ceremony, procedures and requirements.
Although she had known about the official forms in an intellectual way, having them actually loaded onto her desk comp felt very serious. First came a long, depressing series of warnings, restrictions, and discouraging statistics. She had to initial each paragraph as having been read. Formal life partnerships, also known as marriages, the text informed her prosily, failed even among individuals of long-standing fleet background. The report cited all the possible reasons, including some Esme hadn't thought of.
Are there really people who are confused about their gender as adults? And how many people convert to a religion requiring celibacy after marrying someone?
She read on, doggedly interpreting one paragraph after another, until she came to the section warning officers against entanglements with persons of planetary importance. And right there, in a list that included Governor General of this, and Assistant General Secretary of that, and Commander of the other, she found Altiplano, Sector Commanders, Immediate Families of, and Land Bride / Land Groom.
Land Groom?
There wasn't any such title on Altiplano. The whole point of the Land Bride was... Her mind caught up with the warning, and she glanced back at the heading.
Officers are specifically warned to avoid political entanglements, including liaisons, either casual and permanent, with the following classes of persons.
She could hardly avoid a liaison with herself, but what would this mean to Baron? She was a commissioned officer of the regular space service. Surely they couldn't hold her land bride status against her. Not her. But if they did, she hadn't been a land bride when she and Baron met and fell in love. She had been just another ensign. Just another ensign who had survived a mutiny and saved a planet, but basically a fleet officer. She hadn't done anything wrong in falling for Baron, or he for her. What difference did it make that she was also the land bride Sweeza? Come to think of it, had she ever officially informed Fleet that she was the land bride? Lady Katerina Sines knew, but she had been concentrating so on helping get Brunn free, that was far more important, and she wasn't at all sure she'd turned in the form. Esme called up her personnel stats. Planet of origin, family of origin, religion, local awards and decorations, the star mount, she had put that in. But she hadn't mentioned land bride. Feeling guilty already, she hunted through the personnel procedures database for the right form and didn't find one. Well, not that many officers became land bride. In fact, she was the only one. But this meant discussing the lapse with Captain Solis. She would not want to be surprised by it later.
Captain, could I speak to you?
Captain Solis looked up from his work, much less menacing than she had once thought him.
Certainly.
It's about these forms for a change of status. The warnings to personnel?
I don't imagine you're in any trouble. You and the young man are both fleet officers. Unless you still think you're robbing cradles.
No, sir. But the section on planetary entanglements...
I know your father's a prominent person, but you're a fleet officer.
And a land bride.
Land bride? What is that?
Esme handed over the printout she'd made.
A prescribed position, it says here. I don't know if it applies. I am a fleet officer, and when we met, I wasn't land bride Sweeza.
Huh? Land bride must be something extraordinary. What does a land bride do, Lieutenant?
That was not something she could explain when she didn't half understand it herself.
It's... The land bride represents the family's bond to the land, to the soil itself, in the family holdings. She's a symbol of the family's commitment to the land. It's sort of religious.
I didn't even know you were a land bride.
It happened during my leave home after my great-grandmother died. When I came back, we were so busy with the rescue mission, I guess I forgot to put it in. I didn't think about its being important.
Yes. We were all somewhat preoccupied right then. But you need to report it now. Personnel will definitely want to know, and they may have some concerns about your duties, how much time you'll need to be away from Fleet, and so on.
I won't. That's what my father said.
But religion... Religious positions usually require some actual commitment of time and effort, Lieutenant. If you aren't there...
Esme thought suddenly of the spring and fall eveners, when her great-grandmother had ridden out to do something, she didn't know what, in the fields. No one had mentioned that to her.
It all happened so fast. And then I came back.
You need to get it straightened out, whatever it is, before you marry young Serrano. Not just because of regulations, but because you both need to know what you're getting into. And I see here you're in double jeopardy, with your father being a sector commander.
Yes, sir. But they knew that when I went into the prep school.
But you weren't then about to marry into one of the oldest families in Fleet.
The very matter-of-factness of it set a barrier of steel between her and what she hoped for. Esme nodded and withdrew. Master Chief Kataro, after rummaging in the admin database for the correct form, gnawed the corner of her lip. Another dive into the database. Ah. What I think will work is a 7653, an application for exception unspecified, and a 78B4, an incident report, personnel infraction unspecified, and then you'll need a 9245. No, actually two of them. One to accompany each of the others.
Chief Kitaro grinned, looking happier with each additional form.
And it might be just as well to file your 8813, your application for permission for permanent bond, linked to the code tag for your pre-commissioning records, because that will have your prep school classifications, and of course you'll need...
Chief, I'm not going to have the time to do all that at once.
Kitaro had the quiet twinkle of the senior NCO who has just been able to dump a load of work on a junior officer.
Best get started, then. I'll just pipe it to your desk, shall I? Or would you rather work in here?
She could always fill in the blanks while working on something else.
My desk, please, Chief.
Yes, sir.
Filling out the forms to Chief Kitaro's satisfaction kept her busy the rest of that shift and part of the next, along with her other work. For reasons known only to the forms designers and personnel, none of the forms asked for the information in the same order or even the same format, which made it impossible to simply port data from one to the other.
They really do not want land brides to marry into fleet.
Baron's message cube, when she finally had time to put it in the reader, was less informative than she'd hoped. He loved her. She couldn't hear that too often. And he was still waiting to hear from his parents. He was afraid they'd be upset by the administrative decision to make him responsible for the support of the women brought back from Our Texas. It was going to be hard to convince personnel to approve the paperwork for a status change when clearly he couldn't afford any more dependents. Esme wondered if someone in admin had gone bonkers.
Why are they demanding that Baron pay support for these women?
He had included the data he thought she'd need. Evidently, he hadn't yet found the sections of the application which forbade her to exist or him to marry her. He promised to write again, but pointed out that his entire salary going to the support of the New Tex women, he would be limited to ship-to-ship transfers within the fleet postal system. Esme added his information to her paperwork, and then completed what she could of her application, along with the belated Notice of Relationship papers. It was all so silly. They'd known she was a sector commander's daughter when they accepted her into fleet, and Altiplano had no desire to influence the Familius Grand Council anyway. It had never even tried to get a seat in council.
Why is it on the proscribed list? And if they're going to put land brides on, why don't they do the elementary research to find out there's no such thing as a land groom?
Cursing the anonymous they in silence, Esme finished the forms, stamped and thumb-sealed them, and took them back to the captain's office for his clerk to make the required copies and ready them for transit. She went back to the rest of the message cube later. The former ranger's wives, now settled uneasily in an apartment block on Rockhouse Major, were constantly asking Baron for assurances he could not provide.
Grandmother knows why I did it, and agrees that it was justifiable under the circumstances. But she warned me that the fleet would not be pleased, no matter what kind of report she turned in. Everyone, from the women to the admirals, seems to think it's my place to come up with a solution. And I'm stumped. Those women don't seem to be capable of anything but sitting around complaining, and now the civil authorities are jumping on me because they won't send their children to school.
Esme hadn't thought much about the women and children removed, or rescued, on that mission since leaving the task force. She'd assumed the women who had been prisoners had received medical treatment and that someone had done something about the others. Apparently not. Though it was hardly fair to land all the responsibility on Baron. If he was going to be held accountable, then clearly she herself had to do something. But it was a nuisance being stuck on a different ship. They couldn't just talk it over, share ideas, come up with solutions. She prepared queries for Baron and the Fleet Library Search Service, and at the next down jump, sent them off. The idea woke her out of a sound sleep some nights later, and she lay there wide-eyed, amazed at herself. The women needed a place to live and raise their children, preferably on a planet. They needed a way to earn a living. Brunn had suggested the latter with her comments about their skill in handwork. And now Esme had herself thought of a solution to the former problem. Altiplano. As the Landbride Suiza, she could settle them on Suiza lands, in their own village if necessary, where they could follow their own customs. Their handwork could be exported, along with the gene stock, to fill out their income beyond what they could produce from the land. She would be willing to give them a start of livestock from her own personal holdings. Their children could grow up as Altiplanans. In a few generations, they'd be assimilated completely. The more she thought about it, the better it seemed. The women might even find husbands on Altiplano if they wanted them. Since their beliefs fit somewhere on the great branching tree of religions that had grown out of Old Earth Christianity, surely they would find the tone of Altiplano's old believers congenial. She tried not to think of those passages in her child's history book about the religious disputes. Her great-grandmother had insisted that they were all the result of insufficient humility and excessive arrogance. And anyway, religious freedom was now part of the Altiplanan legal code. Though Altiplano lacked the diversity of culture of Fleet or the more cosmopolitan planets. Since she couldn't go back to sleep, she turned on her desk unit and recorded a cube for Baron with the gist of her idea. Then one for Lucy, telling her cousin all about the wedding plans and Baron's problems, and asking about vacancies on Suiza lands. In her mind's eye, she saw them settled somewhere in the south, in a tidy little village of stone houses with kitchen gardens. Something very like what Baron had described as the households they'd come from. By the time she'd populated their pastures with Kateri goats and cantaloupes and imagined them all cheerful and productive with laughing children playing in the lanes, she was sleepy again. She went back to bed, sure that all problems had solutions, and this one had just been solved. Next morning, she was not quite as sure. She thought she remembered that they were free birthers, or at least their men were. But she put the cubes in the outgoing mail collection anyway, and went on with her work. Lucy Suiza came through the front hall on her way in from the polo fields. She needed a shower before the Vicarios family showed up for dinner, and had let Esme's half-brother ride her pony cool. That was one reason, and the other was that she'd seen the little red mail van driving up to the house. Philip had been sending her a note every day. When she was lucky, she got them before anyone else. She picked up his note and a message cube from Esme and took them up to her room. She read the note before she showered, stripping off her sweaty clothes and tingling all over from the phrases he'd used, as well as the cooler air wafting in through the window. Tonight the parents would have their final meeting, and after that, they would be betrothed. After her shower, wrapped in a fluffy white robe, Lucy fed Esme's cube into the reader in her room and brushed her hair as the message came up. Esme was fine. She hadn't heard back from Baron about his family yet. Brun had sent her gorgeous samples of embroidery and sketches for a gown. Fleet had a lot of silly rules about who could marry whom, so she was having to fill out lots of forms. Lucy paused, pinned up her hair, and glanced at the clock. She still had time. She made a long arm, pulled her cosmetics closer to the cube reader, and tried to do her makeup and watch the message at the same time. Fleet didn't approve of officers marrying land brides.
So resign.
Sure enough, the next bit was a long, rambling apology, and then the admission that Esme thought she should resign. She wondered if Lucy was interested. Lucy was interested. She leaned in toward the mirror and applied lip color. No matter what anyone said, there was no way to play polo and end up with soft, moist lips without using cosmetics. The message continued. Lucy kept an eye on the clock. She liked her cousin. She admired her intensely. But Phil would be here in 25 minutes.
Oh!
Esme's wonderful idea of settling the women from our Texas and their children on Suiza lands took her by surprise. The eyeliner she'd been applying so carefully swiped up and away, a dark streak across her face, before she caught herself.
What? 19 women and their children? Dozens of children? All to be settled on Suiza lands? Idiot! Fool!
Then she caught sight of her face in the mirror, and the clock, and the anger roared in her like a brush fire. Lucy dashed into the bathroom, nearly trampling two of the younger children.
Lucy, what happened to your...
Be quiet! Stupid Esme! Ridiculous Esme!
It was a good thing she'd left, and a good thing she wanted to resign as land bride, and Lucy would pluck her hair herself if she had a chance. The Vicario's family had gone back to their city house by midnight. At this third of the formal meetings, alternating from one family's home to the other's, the parents had been pleasantly relaxed. The exchange of gifts, the ritual speeches, the contrived, but still effective, unexpected visit of the priest who put her hand in Philip's and tied a silk scarf around the pair of them had all gone without a hitch. Lucy and Philip had a few minutes alone in the rose garden as their elders watched from the lighted doorway. He kissed her respectfully on the brow and murmured her name. Philip went with his parents when they left, of course. From now on, no more stolen moments, let alone hours, in which to discover each other. From now on, they were formally betrothed, and that betrothal had its own rules. Maddening, perhaps intentionally so. Lucy filched another stuffed date from the tray a sleepy maidservant was carrying back to the kitchen, and followed her father into the library. Her uncle and grandfather, already relaxed in chairs by the fireplace, looked up as she came in.
Lucy, you should be in bed.
Papa, I am not sleepy.
He raised his eyebrows at her, but she didn't move.
Papa, I had a message cube from Esme today.
Esme. Now there's another problem. Berthold, did you get anywhere in the Landsman's Guild?
Nowhere. Oh, Vicarios won't oppose us, but that's because of Lucy, and his support is half-hearted. It would be different if she hadn't left so young, I think. And they don't really remember her. And even though they awarded her the Star Mount and consider her a hero, they do not want a land bride, any land bride, but especially our land bride, connected to an outlander family. Cosco told me frankly that even if she moved here and also her husband, he would oppose it. Nothing good ever came from the stars, he insisted.
And the votes?
Enough for a challenge, Cassie, I'm sure of it. No, the only way out of this is for Esmea to come and talk to them herself.
Or resign.
Or resign, but will she?
She mentioned that in her cube.
What? Resigning? Why?
Her precious fleet seems to think about us the way the Landsman's Guild thinks about them. She says they have some kind of regulation forbidding officers to marry land brides.
Oh, do they have one forbidding officers to be land brides? How ridiculous.
Are you serious? They have something specific about land brides? How would they know?
I don't know. That's just what she said. And she said, why didn't we take in all those women brought back from our Texas? She was sure they'd fit in.
She what? Aren't those women...
Free birthers and religious cultists. Exactly.
But the priests will object.
Not as badly as the Landsman's Guild, if they hear of it. Dear God, I thought she had more sense than that.
Oh, she is in love. Apparently, Fleet is taking Baron's salary to pay for their upkeep. At least some of it. And Esme's trying to help him out. 19 of them, after all. And all those children.
At our expense. Well, that settles it. She'll have to resign as soon as I can get word to her. The trustees will certainly not approve this, if I were willing to let it be known.
Casimir gave Lucy a hard look.
You didn't tell Philip, I hope.
Of course not.
I hope she does name you land bride, Lucy. You'll be a good one.
Lucy had a sudden spasm of doubt, wondering if she was being fair to Esme, who, after all, had had so many bad things happen to her. But underneath the doubt, the same exultation she had felt when Esme gave her the brown mare. Mine. It's mine. I can take care of it. Nobody can hurt it.
I wonder if we could place an Ansible call.
Surely it's not that urgent.
What if she just packs them up and ships them to us? Better safe than sorry.
She won't. I'm sure she won't.
Lucy didn't know how she knew, but she knew. Probably by now Esme had figured out for herself why it was a bad idea, and the next mail would bring apologies.
I hope not. Oh, do go to bed, Lucy. I'm exhausted.
Lucy gave him a kiss and went up to bed, sure she would not sleep for the warring emotions inside her. She undressed quickly, hung her clothes up, and slipped naked between the sheets, taking great lungfuls of the fragrant night air. She hoped Esme felt this way about her baron, If her poor cousin couldn't be land bride, she at least deserved a great love. Esme came onto the bridge to find Captain Solis scowling.
Ugh, now what?
I was afraid I'd lose you.
Lose me?
New orders. They're sending me a new exec, and you over to line ships again. I knew they would eventually. Even though we can always use someone with your talents in SAR, they consider it a waste.
He handed over the message cube.
It's all in here. We'll be dropping you off at Topaz.
Topaz? That's a civilian station.
In transit between ships is a good time to use a few days' leave, Lieutenant. Assuming you have a use for it.
Baron.
Esme's heart hammered. Now if she could only figure out how to manage it.
Navarino is in Sector 6. Gerfalcon, I hear, is going to be detached from picket duty and sent back to Castle Rock, and thence to Sector 1.
Solis did not crack a smile, but she did. She knew the regulations. All she had to do was show up at the right time. The route she chose from Topaz to Sector 6 HQ was her own choice. There was at least a chance that she could meet Baron at some intermediate station. If she could get word to him. If she could get leave. Hustite Fiedi, swordmaster and troop leader, bowed to the chairman's box, then to either end of the grand, where the notable guests of state and industry were seated, and finally, that cold chill down the spine which this required movement always brought, turned his back on the most dangerous man in his universe to salute the mortal representative of that Holy One who was even more dangerous, having dominion over all universes.
Protocol was invented by the devil for the ensnaring of innocent hearts.
Not that his was innocent. He had been debriefed by his superior in the Order and had still to face confession. From the corner of his eye, Hostite saw the doors open in each corner, dark mouths. In each, a gleaming figure poised in one of the attitudes. The first figure in each doorway stalked forward, and behind it, a second. Eight now, each demonstrating one of the attitudes, a full square. Saber dancing had its roots in ancient days, long before the first men left Earth. More than one sword-bearing culture had its sword and knife dances, and more than one had used them as training. But not until the Benignity had the old threads wound into such a line of life and death as this. Step and step, the figures moved forward, in toward the open space, where Hostite waited. Four were female, four were male. Four belonged to the sun. Pure gold, copper red, rich bronze, and brass. Four belonged to the moon. Silver, steel, lead, platinum. And he, the dance's shadow, gleamed obsidian in the light. The gleaming figures had formed the circle, with him in the center. The Spanish circle, he knew from his studies, with its elaborate figures. He turned slowly, enjoying as much as the chairman, he was sure, those fine-tuned bodies beneath the gleaming paint. Unlike his mask, theirs were transparent, invisible to all but those who knew exactly where to look. Instead, their faces, biosculpted to be as beautiful as their bodies, gazed back at him impassively. Tonight's music was chosen by the chairman. He beckoned. Gracefully, yet with a severity imposed by the weapons, four and seven stepped out of the circumference into the circle. In practice, they danced naked but for wrist, elbow, and knee guards, but here, in formal performance, with someone certainly watching from behind the curtain, four wore the small metallic-scaled breast medallions, the pleated metallic-scaled skirt that hung from her hips, and swirled when she moved. Seven wore the loincloth that was hardly more than a codpiece strapped in place. The blades were all steel, but coated to match the dancers' colors. Hostite's blade alone was not steel, but true obsidian, brittle, but sharper than any other. Hostite worried a little about Four. This was her first performance in the Grand, and though she had seemed completely solid in rehearsal, he knew that the excitement of a first performance could cause a fatal misstep. Pellin should have had another half year in the second company, but she was very talented and very dedicated, the best of the understudies. Hostite hoped she would not be marked badly tonight. Hostite signaled for the pairs next. One and five would dance alone at the end, but for now joined four and seven. Hostite worried again about four, She must be shown to be inferior without injuring five or being too badly hurt. Again, he was reassured by her steady, even rhythm under the spectacular moves required. The few thin lines of red on her skin were only enhancements, not serious injuries that would take time from her training or performance. The dance continued, with the other pairs replacing those, 2 and 8 opposing 6 and 3. Here, where Hostite expected no problems, 6 missed his footing in a turn. Perhaps the floor was sweat slick there, or perhaps he lost concentration. Whatever the reason, his left foot slid sideways as his weight came on it, and 2, they were the second figure by then, opened his leg across the knee from the lateral thigh to the posterior calf, exposing bone at the joint, just before the gush of brilliant blood that proved an artery had been severed. Hostite ignored the crowd and gestured to his dancers. 3 and 8 moved aside without missing a beat. 2 backed away and knelt, weapon outstretched. Hostite looked at the chairs box. A hand outstretched. The dancers stopped, held their poses. Silence. Then 6 lay where he had fallen, in a widening pool of blood, struggling not to make a sound. Hostite knew already it was a crippling blow. He might live and walk, but he would never dance again, even if the joint held.
Still, our thanks for your service. It is ended.
Before anyone else could move, Hostite moved, his obsidian blade slicing through the air and 6's throat. He bowed to the chairs box.
Continue.
Hostite returned to his place. 2 still knelt, having no partner. 3 and 8 moved with the music, dancing, avoiding both 2 and the dangerous bright blood. It honored the honorable dead to dance before them, around them. At the end of that figure, the chair gestured again. Now Hostite closed the dead eyes and made the gestures and said the words that sent 6's soul on its way. Servants came, rolled the body into a sling, and carried it out. Others cleaned and dried the floor. Afterward, in the dancers' hall, they all knelt to honor the memory of Steele, and with the edge of a keen blade, each added a drop of his or her own blood to the winding sheet. Pellin looked pale, and no wonder after such a first night. Hostite gave her a hug and held her until her body quit shivering.
You did well. You did very well.
Gunnar Tarakian and Basil Tarakian Junos had the combined investigative skills of any newshound in history, and more than 3 times the discretion. Their profits came not from revealing information, but concealing it. It had not taken them over long to figure out that the drunk who'd accosted them back on Zenebra Main Station had been a New Texas God-fearing militia member, and that the New Texans, as the Tarakians privately referred to them, as opposed to the Texans of the Lone Star Confederation, who were perfectly respectable, if unfailingly sneaky at doin' business, were engaged in terrorism against the Familius Regnant. Since Gunnar and Basil had reported to their respective fathers as soon as they were back aboard Tarakian ships, the Tarakian family had a head start on the Familius Regnant's fleet when it came to planning. They had followed, from a discreet distance, every evidence of Fleet's rescue of Brunn Meager, and the more obvious evidence of her father's mental instability. Now Gunnar and Basil had met again, this time on the family's private resort on Cascadar. Their distant cousin Kaim, the only family member presently serving in Fleet, had taken leave due and was now sprawled on a couch on the wide veranda of Seabreeze, glaring at the rain that poured steadily, as if from a vat overhead.
My only leave in 4 years, and it has to be raining.
It's just the autumn rains.
I hate planets.
Gunnar glanced at Basil, who shrugged. He looked almost as sulky as Kaim.
You chose the time. You know about the climate.
I know more than that. Listen, what have you heard about the rejuvenations going bad?
Well, there was always that story that the Patchcock-made stuff was tainted somehow. A benignity plot, I heard, with a spy found right in the factory, wasn't it?
No, that's just bad drugs.
Kaim waved aside what had been 27% of the market share, and the disgrace and financial ruin of a family with more than a dozen seats in council, as if it were nothing.
What I have is evidence that the primary process may be faulty. Nothing hard yet. They're still blaming it all on something wrong with that batch of drugs. But according to my sources, some of the first repeat rejuvenates are showing mental deterioration. Lord Thornbuckle, for example.
I don't see that. She was his daughter. There's nothing induced in his reaction.
I know. I'm not a parent. But still, risking the security of the entire family.
Thing is, if it's a matter of some drugs being bad, that's very different from the process itself being flawed. Kaim, haven't some of the fleet's senior officers been rejuved?
Yes, but only once. None of them had multiples, unless one of them's had it done privately, though not through medical branch. All the first ones were volunteers, done 40 or more years ago, when there had been enough civilian experience. It wasn't made standard with flag rank for another 20 years. Then they started giving senior NCOs a rejuve about 10 years ago.
So, seen any crazy admirals lately?
There's always Lepescu.
He was born mean. That kind existed before rejuve.
Yes, I know that. Look, this is still very, very classified.
Yeah, right.
Basil crossed his heart elaborately.
It's not the admirals. At least I haven't seen any crazy admirals. Not that I see that many. But there's a medical directive out on senior NCOs. Anyone rejuved in the past 10 years is being called in for immediate evaluation. And I have solid data that at least 8 Master Chiefs have had negative performance evals in our sector alone in the past half-standard year.
Sounds like a bad drug batch to me.
But it could also be intentional. If someone wanted to ruin Fleet, making Master Chiefs nuts would be a very good way to go.
And who would be doing this? Who would have access?
Across the whole organization, if it is that widespread, it would have to be sabotage in procurement or upstream from them. Another traitor.
All organizations have some traitors.
Yes, but what the NCOs are worried about is that it was a plot to start with, so that they could justify not giving rejuve to enlisted personnel. I don't see that myself. Admirals cost more and do less. Everybody knows the senior NCOs are more valuable. But it's spooking them. And having them spooked would suit our enemies. The Benignity? I can see them doing something like this through agents of theirs. Fleet Brass is worried about more traitors in the operational end, like Garavay and Hearn, but why wouldn't the Benignity suborn procurement as well?
I suppose. So either they're going to find out it was a bad batch, and the price of any remaining Moraline Consuline stock will drop through the floor, and the whole Combine will be bankrupt, or they'll find the basic process is flawed, and all rejuve-related products will go down.
Ah, you lot! Is profit all you care about? Doesn't it mean anything to you that if all the Master Chiefs go bonkers, we can't possibly stand against a Benignity or Nutex invasion?
Nutexans are amateurs. That silly drunk.
Isn't the whole story. Just as you said, any organization has its traitors, and any organization also has fools that get drunk.
Still, I do not see that finding your traitors, assuming you have them, is our responsibility. We do, on the other hand, have a responsibility to the family which, by paying taxes, pays your salary too, Cain. So I wouldn't be so smug about your moral purity.
Stop it, both of you. None of us wants to see the Familias fall to invasion, and none of us wants to see the Tarakian family go broke. We're one blood.
Which might, in a few minutes, be mingled on the porch floor if the other two didn't quit posturing. Basil's daughter burst through the door from the dining room, leading her mother by a good 10 feet.
Daddy, found you!
Basil scooped her up, and the child flashed a wide grin at the other men.
Lunchtime!
Gunnar pushed himself up.
Sounds good to me. Come here, little one, and let your father get up.
The child bounced from her father's lap to Gunnar, and he lifted her slight weight to his shoulder.
Don't forget to
duck.
Inside, her mother shook her head.
Oh, sorry, Gunnar. Lydia's John had put something down the toilet in the children's bathroom, and we were coping with the overflow. Jesse got away from us.
Good timing.
Berish was almost as pretty as little Jesse, and Gunnar envied Basil at times like this, remembering those first years of marriage, when the children were sweet lumps of brown sugar, and a wife was an inexhaustible cavern of enchantments. He'd thought of remarrying, but the pain of losing Sela and the children still stabbed. He could not risk that again. He swung Jesse down and followed the others to the great dining table. After lunch, the rain stopped for a while, and Gunnar chivied the men into a walk along the shore, past the orange squares of fish pens. Here, with the distractions of uneven footing and a breeze freshening into a blustery wind, Basil and Caim were less inclined to quarrel. Caim opened his mind, like the net of a fisherman, spilling a mixed lot of information which Gunnar knew he and Basil would pick over at leisure. By dinner time, when the wind had blown the clouds south for a time, Caim was clearly enjoying the once-hated planet. Gunnar himself wanted nothing more than to be back aboard one of the Tarakian family's ships, preferably one with the new decryption algorithms that could intercept transmissions via the financial ansibles. He tried to settle calmly to the after-dinner word games, but he couldn't concentrate. After the third time that Caim crossed his entry with a 10-point bonus, he gave up.
I'm fast. I'm going to bed.
To bed? It's not that late.
I know, but I am that tired.
Gunnar climbed the stairs to his tower room. Basil undoubtedly knew what he was going to do and could be counted on to keep Caim out of the way. The problem was that no security system could really keep his communications clean, not down here. He opened a line to the family headquarters on Kaskadar, requested a data dump of the past 2 days of market reports, and told the duty operator he'd be in the next day to put something in the batch for the Ansible.
By midday local, sir. It goes off at 1300. And we have to have all the data encrypted.
I'll be there by 1000.
When Basil came up hours later, Gunnar was still picking through the data dump.
I thought you were fuzzed.
I am, but I'm also worried. There's something going on with the Consulines. Look at this.
Not now. In the morning. I had to ply Caim with more brandy to keep him downstairs. And if I don't sleep now, I'll be very sorry in the morning.
You'll be sorry longer if you don't look at this. I'm serious, Baz. Something's going on, and it's big. Look at the fluctuations in the Rejuve Index.
It's been volatile ever since the Patchcock mess. Took it 6 months to recover at all. And every little rumor shakes it like a wind chime.
So quit talking and look.
What about the raw...
Over the top...
Gunnar shuffled through the pile to find what he wanted.
I can't be sure without getting a hook in one of the big lines, but I bet that's from the Consuline plants. They're the only single source big enough to draw those resources this fast.
And they'd lost market share. And, damn, cuz, I wish we could access the employment figures.
So, we tell,
the fathers, and we don't tell Caim. I'm preparing an Ansible load for tomorrow.
Today. What time does it have to be in? You want help?
Just keep Caim out of my way.
Gunnar's line of command ran through Basil's father, not his own. Typical of the Tarakian family's organization. So he was surprised when the next message came from his father.
Gunnar, tell Basil to keep Caim on planet another 48 hours without fail. Then get yourself on the next shuttle up.
As God wills.
The family's code for what's going on.
In his grace.
And his father signed off. So he had put his finger on the lion's eyelid. Well, now to convince Basil to trap Caim and let him run off. The shuttle ride to the orbital station seemed to take forever, though he knew it was the standard flight time. When he arrived, he went directly to the Tarakian shipping offices, where staff were bustling around as if a ship were arriving.
Who's coming?
We just got word by Ansible. Flavor is on her way through. Fast transit with something urgent. If you want a lift, I'm sure they'll have room for you.
Favored of God, nicknamed Flavor, was the Tarakian's fast courier, and the family's most advanced recon vessel, loaded with the best scan equipment money or influence or trickery could obtain.
There she is.
A bright splash on the screen meant something had come through the jump point at max V, and the color shift meant she was making a dangerously fast approach. So whatever it was, the fathers were willing to let everyone know they had some urgent chore in hand. Usually, Tarakian ships moved in the same stately arcs as any other commercial carrier, never showing all their capacity unless they ran into trouble.
What's his ETA?
At this rate? Under 20 hours.
20 hours? So why did my father tell me to leave downside immediately? So I would be gone before word of Flavor's arrival got to the surface? So perhaps Kaim wouldn't connect the two? So there would be no transmissions to the surface which Kaim might intercept?
While the station had a perfectly comfortable lodging house for transients, and he had more than enough credit to use it, he knew, without even asking, that his father expected him to stay in the office, in the off-duty bunk room for low-level staff, with its hard, narrow beds.
I'm going over to Spotted Lamb for lunch, if anyone wants me.
He was almost through with dessert, honeyed figs stuffed with chopped bitsai nuts, when the call came. A tight-beamed packet for him from Flavor. Adhem, the office manager, gave him a look, which Gunnar had no trouble interpreting. He wasn't that senior in the family. He was just another of the young men moving up through the ranks. So why was he suddenly in the office at just the right time for the appearance of Flavor on a fast run, and why was he getting this packet instead of someone more senior? He was moving up, not down or sideways, because he knew better than to give Adhem any information at all. Flavor's commander met him at the hatch and threw her arms around him. Laissa, Basil's sister, had the same dangerous energy as her brother. As Gunnar's chain of command went through his uncle, so Laissa's went through Gunnar's father.
You're coming with us.
Gunnar detached himself.
That's nice. Basil says to give you his love.
We'll fuel and go.
Gunnar nodded and went through the hatch ahead of her. In the next few hours, he briefed her on what he thought he had learned from Kaim and the more accessible data channels.
Here's what you don't know. There was a distant family member captured with Elias Madero, a young girl, Hazel Takeris. About 70 years ago, a Terrakian boy fell in love with the Chapapas girl.
A Greek?
Yes, from Delphi Duetti. Of course, both families disapproved, so they changed their names. They call themselves Takeris. Had lots of children, in defiance of everyone, including six boys, who continue the habit of defying parents by becoming perfectly ordinary merchant crewmen, who married late and had few children. This girl is the Tarakian boy's great-granddaughter. Her father was killed by the new text that bordered Elias Madero.
Gunnar listened, trying to find some connection with the news he'd brought from Kaim.
At the time we heard about the ambush, we didn't know that. The original connection's name was off our books. Then Aunt Herdion saw the news reports and thought the newsie had misspelled Tarakian. You know what she's like. She got on the comm all ready to chew bones. They gave her all the information they had, just to get her off their backs. Shortly after the rescue, when the newsies reported Hazel's survival, she barged into the remaining Takeris family discussion of Hazel's future and insisted on having a say. In fact, she was all set to adopt the girl herself. They're not too happy with her, but they're also not rich. So her offer to pay for Hazel's education sweetened the deal.
Yes, but what does this have to do with the rejuvenation drugs and rejuve psychosis?
Not much. But you need to know all that to understand some recent decisions by the family council. They hadn't paid much attention to your report from Zenebra about the new tech saboteurs there. But now they consider that the new tech forms a possible serious threat to Tarakian shipping specifically, because of the way we have been casual about picking up replacement crew. And because you and Basil caught that agent on Zenebra. There's also concern about spies in the shipping agent's staffs. They're convinced that the raiders knew about the Elias Madero's deviation from its filed flight plan.
I'd say half the merchanters who work in that area know about that shortcut.
No more. At least not Tarakian ships. We're restricted from anything but green-lined routes.
Oh, that'll put paid to our fast courier service.
Yes, but we won't be subject to piracy. At least not that kind of piracy.
So, what about this rejuvenation stuff? I still think we need to suck some data off the financial ansibles.
Laissa handed him several cubes.
We have. I'm not sure what it all means, though. That one's from Benedictus, and this one's from Cascadar 3 weeks ago. We'll suck it again on the way out.
Where are we going?
Where God and the Father's will. I haven't been told yet.
Gunnar settled down to data analysis. While the price of rejuve drugs had bounced up and down with every rumor of contamination or scarcity, the price of the raw materials had been growing, slowly at first, since the Patchcock mess. Somebody was buying the stuff in quantity. Rejuve drugs used some of the same raw materials as many other pharmaceuticals, but some were unique to that process. He highlighted them. The prices rose steadily. So, somebody was buying, and presumably using the raw materials to make the finished drugs, for which they had, or expected to have, a market. He kept digging, paused to eat, slept a while, and woke to Laisa's call.
We have the new squirt.
Gunnar rubbed his eyes.
And the destination, oh beauteous one?
Marfolk.
Marfolk. An obscure world. He'd heard the name, but knew nothing about it.
How long?
8 days, about.
I'm going back to sleep.
But he didn't sleep. The new data he hadn't seen kept him awake. Finally, he rolled out of the bunk and punched it in.
You didn't tell me you intercepted the memo.
You were sleepy.
Not now.
It had been encrypted, but Flavor's systems were designed to handle all the standard commercial encryption schemata. Under the first level of encryption was another, as usual, simpler. The decryption machine made short work of that, too. Then, finally, the code. Gunnar looked at it and let his mind freewheel. Something about it looked familiar. Then it came to him. Consuline Senior Family Branch.
Laisa, do we have a code chip for Consuline Senior Branch?
Not on board. Is that what you think you've got?
Looks like it. We can start running it past the other chips, but I'm betting on that one.
Gunnar tipped his head one way, then the other. The Consuline memo looked almost readable as it was, but he knew that was deceptive. Nothing was ever that simple. Then the pattern popped out at him, as if someone had outlined words in red ink.